Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio Supreme Court Justice Evelyn Lundberg Stratton announced last week that she will step down from the bench at the end of the year, 2 years short of completing her third term. She was appointed to the High Court in 1996 by then-Governor George Voinovich after serving on the Franklin County Court of Common Pleas. She has devoted much of her judicial career to the issues of those with mental illness who find themselves in a revolving door with the criminal justice system. She's with us today in the studio to talk about her work going forward. Welcome to the show, Justice Stratton.
Thank you. It's a delight to be here, and I am thrilled to have a chance to talk to your listeners.
You have said that the ethical restrictions on you as a judge have kept you from fully pursuing an advocacy road in the area or in the field of mental health or some other area or anything really. But your status as a member on the Ohio Supreme Court has also given you a rare pulpit from which to advocate, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's sort of a job where people return your phone calls, and I've taken advantage of it by trying to put together the coalitions and the collaborations and getting people together to work on these issues. So it's been an absolute blessing in that regard. The ethical restrictions are that we are only allowed to advocate for issues affecting the administration of justice. So we have to be very careful that we don't advocate for just common issues that are policy decisions that a legislature would decide. So I always been very, very careful of those ethical boundaries and just made sure that whatever I worked on really related to the court system. Now I can expand those horizons when I leave the bench.
You said that no job offers are on the table, or at least you did last week, I think, and that you haven't talked to anyone about your next job. I wondered if you're thinking of creating your own next job, maybe creating or forming an organization yourself.
Well, I'm not planning to really form any organization. What I really, I've been doing a lot kind of as within my job, I've been doing a lot of national speaking and consulting, working with other courts, with other jurisdictions, trying to get them to use the mental health court system, working a lot on veterans. And those are agencies, those are a lot of nonprofits that I would probably work with and consult with on a contract basis. I don't really want to create another whole structure out there. There's plenty of structures out there to work with. But I just felt it was not appropriate to enter into any discussions with anybody until I really made my decision and announced it and was able to do that openly.
My guest is Ohio Supreme Court Justice Evelyn Lundberg Stratton. She's leaving the bench at the end of the year, retiring but not retiring. Just, I guess, resigning but not retiring
resigning
is a better way to put it.
Going off on a new career.
A new chapter. If you have a question or comment for Justice Stratton, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org, and you can go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your question or comment there if you like. If you did form an organization, just, you know, in the dream scenario, what would it be? What would it do? I guess what's left to do that's not getting done in the current matrix of the social, judicial, and governmental services that interest you?
Well, as I've worked on these issues for the past 16 years, I have seen increasingly the importance of the role that the court plays in trying to be a convener, a collaborator, to pull all the different silos together. I mean, that's exactly what a mental health court judge does. Instead of saying to your defendant, all right, you go see this person, you go see the mental health person, you go see the drug and alcohol, you need a job, you might qualify for Social Security. They never make the first place. They go back under the bridge. And the judge is able to pull all those people together and say, let's talk, let's break down these silos, let's deal with this person as a whole. And so that is sort of it's not necessarily an organization, but it's something I would really want to try to teach judges that they have the power and the ability to do that. And that's part of the speaking that I do is try to encourage judges to understand that they can be agents of social change fully within their ethical boundaries.
Do you intend to stay current as a lawyer? I mean, keep your licensing and your...
I intend to keep my license active, but I don't want to practice law. I'm not interested in going back and practicing law and trying lawsuits and giving legal advice. I really want to be more in the area of championing the social changes that will make our courts much more efficient and really get people out of the court system, break the cycle of recidivism. So I'm not really interested in hanging up a shingle or joining any firm just to practice law.
Why do you think that these issues have been before the courts forever? They're old as dirt. Why do you think you became so interested in them as a judge?
Well, when I was a trial judge here in Franklin County, I served a full term and then was appointed in the beginning of my second term in Franklin County. And I saw people all the time in my court that had mental health issues. But our mental health system wouldn't take them if they had a felony. Our drug and alcohol system wouldn't take them if they had a mental health issue. There were not good resources. And I just sort of foolishly thought, well, if I put them in prison, they might get better treatment and it will protect the public. And that really ended up being the worst solution because the jails were fully unable to deal with it. What we had in the 1950s was a very noble social movement to close down some of the horrible mental health hospitals that existed and put them in what they call the least restrictive environment. And so we started closing down all the hospitals. We had about 350,000 people in hospitals in the 1950s. We have only about 70,000 left in hospitals nationwide, mostly because they're there for criminal convictions, forensic convictions.
Which means there are no beds left.
Yeah, there's no beds left. And they all have been put out in the community, but we never created the structure in the community to take care of them. And so what happened is they cycled back into jails and prisons as the de facto mental health hospital. Los Angeles County Jail is the largest mental health facility in the country. Rikers Prison in New York is the second largest. And so that's the cycle we got to reverse again. But we've got to create those supports in the community if we're going to reverse that cycle.
It was something like, I think, 1 out of 300 beds, 1 out of 300 Americans. There was a bed for 1 out of 300 Americans, and it's up to like, or down to 1 out of 3,000 Americans or something like that.
That sounds about right. But I just know that there's very few opportunities. And in Ohio, as in many states, to even get committed to be able to stay in a hospital under an involuntary commitment, you have to almost be stabbing somebody. Because police, I've heard so many families say, well, I called the police. My child's, you know, out of control. They're very dangerous. The police will say, well, have they actually hurt anybody? No. Well, we can't do anything. I mean, there's just that level of you have to be so close to killing somebody, hurting somebody, damaging somebody. And we got to find some way in between to deal with those people that haven't reached that level but clearly need help.
You're part of a strong 6-1 Republican majority on the court. The Ohio Chamber of Commerce, which spent millions financing ads in support of yours and other elections to the high court, has said that you'll be missed. How should your replacement be chosen, do you think?
Well, first of all, we don't like to think of ourselves as a Republican court. We take our nonpartisan status very, very seriously. Mm-hmm. And no one on that bench ever talks politics when we're deciding cases. We tend to be conservative. We believe in judicial restraint. But we strongly resent when the media calls us a Republican bench because we're very particular about being nonpartisan.
But it is an elective office.
It is an elective office, and it is a nonpartisan elective office. And I won in my first race. I won Cuyahoga County, and I won Mahoning, and I won Trumbull in my last race. So these counties that tend to vote very overwhelmingly Democrat will look at you as a candidate and a nonpartisan candidate. Mm-hmm. When I talked to the governor, I did not have a particular person in mind because the only person I had in mind that I would have recommended was not interested in doing it. So I said to him, just please pick the best person possible, regardless of politics, somebody you can be so proud of. And of course, he said, do you think I would do anything else? But he assured me that he's going to pick somebody that, in his opinion, is going to be so above reproach and so well respected that people will say that's a good choice. And I said, Governor, that's all I can ask.
Some have suggested setting up a committee, like a merit selection committee in this case.
He indicated
start
he was going to have
trend.
Yeah, he was going to have a committee make recommendations to him. How he structures that, I don't know, because this unfortunately, this got on a fast track because somebody leaked it to the media, and the media broke the story, and I had to accelerate my whole game plan of announcing that I was stepping down. So he obviously was kind of caught off guard. But he said he's planning to do a committee some sort.
So he was caught off guard too. He didn't know
I was
either.
Caught off guard. I was not planning to be quite. I was going to roll this out in a couple of weeks in a very orderly fashion, with notifying certain people first, like the governor, then my justices, and then my party chair, and it just all kind of went crazy.
If you have a question or comment for my guest, Ohio Supreme Court Justice Evelyn Lundberg Stratton, you can give us a call 614-292-8513. Don in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Morning. I was wondering, in the light of streamlining drug courts and other mental illness problems, if the judge had any feelings or thoughts of Senator Ken Yucco's efforts to decriminalize marijuana for medical purposes in the state of Ohio.
Well, I'm still currently a sitting justice, and I will be for six more months. And those are one of the ethical restrictions I was talking about. We cannot take positions on cases that might come before us. There have been ballot movements on that issue. There's currently a movement to do something like that. So at this point, I can't comment on that issue. Those are one of the things I will be able to comment after January 1st. But because that is an issue pending, I can't.
Thanks a lot, Don. When you were talking to the governor about your replacement, did he give you any indication that he would be actually open to appointing a Democrat to replace you?
We didn't discuss that at all, no.
You serve in other capacities besides the court, but also because of your place in the court. For example, you were appointed to a committee set up by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs to help put together a program called the Veterans Justice Outreach Program. And in December, you and Ohio Attorney General Mike DeWine convened the first meeting of the Attorney General's Task Force on Criminal Justice and Mental Illness. Are you going to retain your positions on those kinds of committees?
Yes, I already talked to Mike DeWine, and we discussed that I would continue, hopefully, for a good while as co-chair of the task force. Those are things that are very near and dear to my heart. I got a lot of people that called and said, oh, you know, you're leaving. What are we going to do? Who's going to champion these movements? And I'm like, no, you don't understand. I'm going to have more time to champion them. I don't have to read 5 feet of briefs every 2 weeks like I have to do now. I do give my court job first priority. I had never wanted anyone to say that I was sloughing off on my job. So I give it top priority. But I've essentially been doing two full-time jobs, so now I'll be able to do one full-time job. But yes, I plan to continue in that, and I'm still working very actively with the VA on the Veterans Justice Outreach Specialist programs, and I will ramp that part of it up considerably.
What was the tipping point for you as far as making that decision to exit?
I think there were a couple things at play. When I finished my last election, and a statewide election, at least the way I run mine, is just very consumptive. It's 7 in the morning to 11 at night, county after county. And I was able to use it both times, last times I ran, to promote crisis intervention training, to promote mental health courts. But I have to shut down all of my national work and my national advocacy because I simply don't have time. So I was very reluctant to run a third statewide race. Fourth. That would be a fourth statewide race. I also felt that after 16 years of reading two feet of briefs every 2 weeks, it was time to move on to something because that job should go to somebody who's excited and fresh about it. And I was really more excited and fresh about the work I was doing and for advocacy of those issues. So I kind of came to a head and I said, okay, what do I really want to do more? And do I want to walk away from such a secure job that's comfortable and I know it inside out and I've done it for years? But no, I was ready. I was ready to take the plunge. So I had a final chat with my husband and did the big gulp, and he was completely and 100% supportive of what I wanted to do. So I decided to go for it.
Anyone on the court try to talk you out of it?
Because I had to do it on a fast track, I had to tell them so quick. And then I immediately, after court, had to leave for Cleveland to give a speech on veterans issues. So I haven't really seen them because everybody, as soon as court's done, everybody goes back to their hometown. So we're getting together again next week. So I'm sure we'll have a chance to talk more in more detail. But yeah, a couple of them were trying to say, are you sure you want to do this? Can't you last two more years? And I appreciate that. But it's time.
My guest is Ohio Supreme Court Justice Evelyn Lundberg Stratton. We'll continue our conversation after this break. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, inside the Obama re-election campaign, we'll hear a deep report on how the president's team hopes to get the job done. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point is this afternoon from 1 until 2 on 89.7 NPR News. 69 degrees with sunshine in downtown Columbus. Expect sunny skies today and a high right around 77 degrees. Showers are expected tonight, mainly after midnight, a low of 59. And showers and thunderstorms off and on throughout the day on Friday, a high of 67.
Support for 89.7 comes from Bonobo on Long Condos, offering homeownership opportunities in the King Lincoln District featuring green design buildings within walking distance of local stores and restaurants. Details at homeportohio.org/Bonobo on Long.
All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Ohio Supreme Court Justice Evelyn Lundberg Stratton. She announced last week that she's going to step down from the bench at the end of the year, 2 years short of completing her third term. She was appointed in 1996. If you have a question for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Remember, she's still on the court, so she's not going to comment on things that on policy issues that don't directly address the administration of the court. She's also very involved in Veterans Affairs and mental health courts and that sort of thing. If you want to give her a call and talk about that, 614-292-8513. Of course, you never know what she might answer, so call and you can always ask. In an online interview by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, you were asked how the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act affected people who are homeless and involved in the criminal justice system. And you said, and again, this was an online interview, but you said that it creates unprecedented opportunities for those people. Major components, if not the entire law, could be swept away by the U.S. Supreme Court sometime next month when it rules on a challenge to the law. What can states like Ohio do if that occurs? How can states make up for the loss of that opportunity that you mentioned?
Well, one of the main issues that every single mental health court, vet court, drug court face is lack of treatment resources. We often see young males, often black males, Asian males, and they are usually not eligible for any sort of Medicaid. They don't, you know, if they don't have families, they don't get any Medicaid or Medicare issues. So there's just no treatment resources available, and so you can't be very effective in recidivism if you can't get at the root of why they're there. The Affordable Care Act really brings in a huge amount of the uninsured into its coverage umbrella. And there's always a question of how you're going to get them into the system, because a lot of them will not simply volunteer and go and get signed up for coverage. So many of them will enter into that coverage system if it is left intact by the U.S. Supreme Court. Will enter it through the court system. They will be the first time they will ever access health care or mental health care, because they are now in a court system. The court says, "This, you are covered. Go get care." If that goes away, the states really are going to have to step up to the plate and provide some sort of resources for additional treatment. And I know that Governor Kasich is very interested in keeping the level of treatment that we have, and he's added some additional resources, because without the treatment, you really don't deal with the problem.
The Ohio General Assembly just passed a bill that gives broader freedoms to former convicts, lightens up the load on them when they get out, gives them... eliminates licensing restrictions and that sort of thing for different kinds of jobs. What kind of impact do you think that sort of trend might have?
Well, the judges were very involved. Our Ohio judges were very involved in helping to put together that package. They were, several of them served on the committee, and several people from our task force served on the committee. That's extremely important, because if you're going to, the vast majority of all criminal defendants come back in the community, and if you don't do something to help them survive and make it in the community, then they're going to end up right back in the system. The public safety issues remain. The best way to reduce crime and to improve public safety is to help them find a way to make it back into the community with education, with treatment, with removing some of these barriers, many of them very, very artificial. So, for example, I can remember when I was a trial judge, I would often have to take the driver's license away from somebody, because the federal law said if you want to do this, you have to take your driver's license away or you don't get the federal money. So we take the driver's license. Now they can't work. And so they can't work. They can't pay their child support. You know, don't have any way to get to a job. It was just so many things like that were so counterproductive. And so this bill takes a look at what's counterproductive, what really doesn't make sense. And let's get rid of those barriers that really don't have any relationship to the crime, and simply are there because it sounded like a good idea at the time to some particular legislator.
Yeah, well, I was covering the legislature back when they were passing a lot of these restrictive laws, and a lot of it was that tough on crime era. Mm-hmm. Are we being less tough on crime when we loosen up the restrictions?
We are actually not being any less tough on crime. What we're being is smarter on crime. We were finding out that people who are low-level offenders, the Ohio prisons had 50,000 people plus in their prison system. 30,000 of those 50,000 are in there for less than a year. That means we are churning 30,000 judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, police officers, resting them. They're in there less than a year. They get no treatment because they're not in there long enough. Many of them have spent a long time in the local jail, so they're only in the prison system a short period. And we put them back out on the street. And that seems to be a very foolish way to deal with it. So if we, instead of putting that 30,000 into prison for a year or less for mostly lower-level offenses, we put them into a community environment where they have accountability, they have to get a job, they have to work. Makes a huge difference. Keep them attached to their families. You reduce the recidivism rate. You improve the public safety. It was a foolish way we were doing it. And the whole sentencing reform is an effort to reverse that. And then the people who really deserve to be in prison, who are really a threat to community, who will be a recidivator no matter what, we keep them in. And that really is the way to deal with it.
You mentioned the churn, that there are so many of them are there for a year or close to a year or less and not there long enough to get the treatment they need. Is there any effort, or do you think there should be some effort to speed up the treatment process and getting people processed more quickly?
Well, it's that is a difficult thing to do because it all depends on how long their trial takes. If they're in jail, in a local jail, and their trial's continued and they have to, you know, they're 20 days, they're 100 days, they're 150 days, depends on how many continuances.
You don't really start anything.
Yeah, you
that.
Don't start. And then the local jail won't start anything because they don't know how long they're going to be there. They don't know when the trial's going to happen. And by the time they get to the big prison, they may have half their sentence actually served, because they get jail time credit for the time they spent in the local court. And then they have to be processed out, so they go to the processing out center. So a lot of that's being changed. Director Moore is very, very creative, and he is putting
together... At the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections.
Correct. Thank you. And he's putting together these centers that really will work with these prisoners who are going to go out. Their sentence is done. They're going to go out. But how do we train them, help start connecting them with services, help start connecting with job interviews, before we open that door? Before, with a person who had a mental health issue, had been in prison, let's say, 5 years, maybe they got in prison at 20, now they're 25 and they're getting out. In the old system, they were given $75 and 2 weeks of medication. Bye-bye. Just an average person can say, that's not going to work. They're not going to succeed. So we're trying to change that whole paradigm.
Jimmy in Dayton, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Jimmy. Hello, Jimmy.
Hi. Anne, I listen to your show a lot, and I particularly like the shows when you deal with people with mental issues, and I'm glad.
I'm sorry, Jimmy, we lost you.
I'm still here.
Okay.
All right. I thank you for your show, and Justice, I appreciate you being here. My question really comes from my heart. I had the opportunity to have somebody from the criminal system that had mental challenges for about 3 months, and I couldn't understand why this child, really, was 18 years old, was being criminalized instead of getting treatment. Why does it take the courts to get treatment for somebody who has mental challenges?
Well, that's one of the questions that we have, that I asked. Why are they in the court system for the first time and they've never had treatment in the other system? A lot of it is because they don't on their own seek treatment, and our system as it currently exists doesn't force treatment on anybody. And so they get so bad, or they start self-medicating, or they are in the throes of a delusion when they commit their crime, and now they end up in the court system. And what we strongly encourage our judges is to set up a diversion program. So instead of getting them a conviction on their record, if they at all could qualify for diversion, they get the treatment, they get the community supports in diversion, and then their conviction is erased, or they don't get a conviction at all. And so a lot of our municipal level courts, we try to encourage diversion instead of a conviction pattern so that we get them out of the system without a criminal record.
Thanks, Jimmy, for that question. If you're just joining us, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And my guest is Ohio Supreme Court Justice Evelyn Lundberg Stratton. She has announced just last week that she will be leaving the court at the end of the year. Questions or comments for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.com. www.thepassthirtyyears.org. Your parents were missionaries in Southeast Asia, and you spent your childhood in South Vietnam. You attended schools there. I assume they were English-speaking schools, right?
Yes, it was a school that was directly set up for missionary kids from Southeast Asia. I was born in Thailand. My roommate was born in Vietnam. My other roommate was born in Indonesia. So we kind of considered ourselves like from the country. I was a Thai kid. My roommate was a Vietnamese kid, even though we all had American parents. And we all learned English from our parents, but we all then had the native tongue of the country we grew up in. So you talk about a real melting pot. It was a serious melting pot of different cultures and countries.
When you're in a situation like that and going to a school like that, do you feel like you really do get to know the country?
Not really. When I went to boarding school in South Vietnam initially, I was 6 years old, so I had to leave my parents at six for 9 months out of each year, which certainly taught me to grow up and stand on my own 2 feet because we only had one dorm parent for 40 kids. But when I initially was there, we didn't have that much interaction with the local population because we were 6 years old. You can't go downtown by yourself and that sort of thing. We would do more group outings. But then the war got worse and worse. And so we got more and more confined to campus so that at the end, before our school evacuated in 1967, we were not allowed to leave campus at all. It was far too dangerous. When our school moved to Malaysia, it was we had much more ability to interact. But Malaysia was so thoroughly taken over by the British that everybody spoke English. So we never learned native Malaysian. The kids that grew up in Indonesia could speak a form that could communicate with the Malaysians. But we did a lot of sports with the local schools and a lot of interaction with that. So we had a little more chance. But even the town in Malaysia where I went to boarding school was one side of one street. So it was not a very big community.
You returned to the United States to attend college. I guess you kind of had to come back to the United States. You weren't a citizen anywhere else, right?
Well, I was a Thai citizen, too. I was an American citizen and a Thai citizen. I chose to stay as an American citizen. At that time, we had to choose, and so I gave up my Thai citizenship. But our parents were all college educated. Our mission required a college education to become a missionary. And so we were always encouraged to come back to America and go to college. But a lot of the missionary kids have gone back overseas in United Nations work, in aid work, and as missionaries themselves, they just felt comfortable going back to the country they grew up in. They call us third culture kids. We're not totally American. We're not totally Thai. We're kind of in between somewhere. And if you know me really well and live with me, you see those differences a lot more.
Like, give me an example.
Well, I still am trying to learn the English language. Oh. I learned basic English.
Well, so are a lot of people. So.
My mother used a picture dictionary to try to teach me words about that I would not encounter, like fire engine. We didn't have fire engines. And when I went to boarding school, because it was a very strict religious boarding school, they felt that movies and everything and TV were evil, so we had no movies or TV. So we read. So I was reading books with, you know, Quo Vadis and War and Peace, these huge words, but I never heard anybody pronounce them growing up because we all spoke basic English. So I have this very large vocabulary, and if I try to use a big word, I usually pronounce it the way I saw it in my mind and wrong, and my husband's about the only one that corrects me. So
well,
I try to stay
job,
away from big words.
In my job, people have no compunction about correcting me after the show's
well,
over.
Well, as a justice, they do.
614-292-8513 if you want to give us a call and speak with my guest, Ohio Supreme Court Justice Evelyn Lundberg Stratton. Dave and Bexley, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Dave. Oh, sorry. Dave's not ready. Sorry. Okay. Dave, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Hi. I've got a quick question. The court makes a lot of important decisions, and I wondered how they mesh with the legislature, if there's a training period or if there's any consulting with the legislature about important bills that come up that might or might not be constitutional, things like that.
No, there is no consulting whatsoever. We are actually very careful to stay out of any of the policy-making, decision-making process at the legislative side because we may have to rule on the constitutionality. I know that the legislature does have a whole staff that looks at the constitutionality or that researches things, but occasionally I will hear phrases from legislators like, well, we passed that bill. We knew it might be challenged on a constitutional basis, so we left that for you to figure out. And so we get the case to have to decide whether it's constitutional. We don't have any training sessions, but we do try to collaborate. And for example, we encourage our legislators to go visit their local judges, spend a day in their court, see what the process is like. We likewise encourage our judges to come do a visit. We have a judge visit day with the legislators to see what their job is like, because we believe if we promote understanding between the branches, we will both do our own jobs more effectively. But those roles are very distinct and very separate.
Well, is there any opportunity to say, well, there's a big gap in the law here, and it's going to be a problem? Do you ever have that opportunity?
We often say that through our opinions. A lot of times people want us in a court setting to change a law that they don't like. And we are a court that believes in judiciary restraint. We believe that there's only, you know, if it takes four votes to change the law. And so we leave it to the legislature to set policy, and we really rule on constitutionality. But sometimes you'll see opinions where they say, we think the legislature needs to address this, or we think the legislature needs to fix this, or we may have one of our persons go to the legislature and say, here's a gap that affects the courts, and so you need to fix this. But we have to stay limited, again, to the court functions.
Okay.
Okay, Dave. Thanks for your call. Take care. When you returned to the United States to attend college, were you originally intending to return to Asia and, you know, have some kind of career that led you there, whether it was missionary work or something else?
Actually, I kind of, in a roundabout way, did. When I first came back, my first major was nuclear physics. That was my lifetime dream at the point.
Wow.
And the college I went to dropped the nuclear physics program in the middle of it. And I sort of, growing up, you know, when you grow up in the circumstances, you sometimes don't appreciate it until you leave it. And after I left Thailand, I thought, wow, I really want to go back in United Nations work and embassy work. And so I transferred to the University of Florida to take an international relations major. And I met my former husband, who is from Ohio, which is how I got to Ohio, right before I transferred. And I realized he was not going to follow me to Florida, let alone overseas. So it was like, what do I do with the rest of my life? And I played the piano for a quartet that traveled and sang for the school recruiting, and my chaperone said, well, you like to write and you like to act. Why don't you become a lawyer? Now, I had never seen Perry Mason, because we didn't have TV most of my life. I'd never seen a lawyer. I'd never seen a judge. But it sounded like something I could do wherever he went. So I decided to go to law school. Well, I still have this very religious streak. And somewhere along the way of thinking of becoming a lawyer came the idea I wanted to become a judge. So from the day I went to law school, I knew I wanted to be a judge. And my career has proven that the good Lord has led me in these directions. And I feel very comfortable with the choice I made.
Coming up, I'm going to be talking about TEDx Columbus and the TED Talks in general. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but it's where people with great ideas have 18 minutes or less to give the talk of their life. If you had 18 minutes or less to give the talk of your life, what would it be about?
It would be to tell people that they really can make a difference no matter how big or small they are. So many of our judges did not start a mental health court on their own. They started because a probation officer or police officer with crisis intervention training said, you know, judge, I think we need to do something. So I like to challenge people to believe that even if they move some needle 1 inch, they can make a difference in someone's life, whether it's just going across the street and taking care of that neighbor that's got no relatives left. So I just want to encourage people to give back, because we live in such a rich, fortunate country compared to the rest of the world. And I think we all have an obligation to give back. So that would be my message.
Well, thanks for joining us today to share that.
Thank you.
It's just Ohio Supreme Court Justice Evelyn Lundberg Stratton. She'll be leaving the bench at the end of the year. Coming up, if you're curious about what I meant by those TED Talks, stay with us. We'll be talking about that after this. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Receive daily updates from WOSU by liking our station on Facebook or by following WOSU News on Twitter. Another way to connect with us is by subscribing to our Daily News Loop e-newsletter. Visit wosu.org/email to sign up.
And WOSU Public Media presents the Chefs in the City online auction. You can bid now on fabulous culinary-themed packages. Bid on items such as a wine-crafting experience package from Camelot Cellars, or a private stand-up wine tasting and hors d'oeuvre reception for 20 at the refectory. But hurry, these packages and more close today, this Thursday. All proceeds benefit children's educational programming on WOSU. Visit wosu.org/chefs. To view all items up for bid. And stay right here in just about 20 minutes. Hour 2 of All Sides begins, and we'll have an open forum to discuss the issues you are talking about. That's an open forum from 11 till noon on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. And it's 69 degrees in downtown Columbus. Sunshine today, warming up to a high of about 77. Showers are likely for tonight, mainly after midnight, a low of 59 degrees. Showers off and on throughout the day on Friday with a pop-up thunderstorm here and there, a high of 67 degrees. Clouds Friday night, a low of 49. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
The TED Radio Hour premieres on WOSU Radio this Saturday. The show is based on the annual TED conferences that bring together the world's most fascinating thinkers to give the talk of their lives in 18 minutes or less. Here's an example from author Malcolm Gladwell, who asks, what does spaghetti sauce have to do with happiness?
And Prego turned to Howard and they said, are you telling me that one-third of Americans crave extra chunky spaghetti sauce and yet no one is servicing their needs? And he said, yes. And Prego then went back and completely reformulated their spaghetti sauce and came out with a line of extra chunky that immediately and completely took over the spaghetti sauce business in this country. And over the next 10 years, they made $600 million off their line of extra chunky sauces.
I could have thought of that. Like hundreds of cities around the globe now, Columbus has its own version. It's called TEDx Columbus. Joining us now to talk about our local version and what's coming up for the next TEDx Columbus is a former TEDx speaker, David Staley of the Goldberg Center for Excellence in Teaching at OSU. He's also a curator for the upcoming TEDx, and he's going to co-host the upcoming TEDx Columbus Conference in October. Welcome to the show, David.
Thanks, Ann. Thanks for having me.
A few basic points about TEDx Columbus, perhaps. It'll be on October 5th, and with the second TEDx Youth at Columbus on October 3rd.
That's right.
Both at COSI. Tell us about what TEDx Columbus is going to bring to us this year.
The theme of this year's TEDx is The Future Revealed. And as you said, it'll be on October 5th this year. We're moving it up. Those that attended last year, notice we're moving it up about a month or so that we can anchor it, align it with the Ideas Festival. It'll be occurring that week as well.
The Columbus Ideas Festival.
The Columbus
right.
Ideas Festival.
And you're hosting an open call audition for speakers on August 16th at the Columbus Museum of Art to fill three to four of the speaker slots. Have you done open auditions before? And why the change, if not?
Yeah, this is new this year, and we did this in response to some feedback we received from participants in previous years. What we're imagining is something that looks like an American Idol kind of setup, where anyone can come and in 1 to 3 minutes give a mini talk of their life. And we will choose up to three people to be on stage this year at TEDx.
What are you looking for with something like that?
The talk of your life. We're seeking...
But what does that mean?
Compelling speakers with a diverse lineup of speakers. We are interested in what Ruth Milligan likes to call principal investigator types. Researchers, artists, innovators, creatives, people who are out to change the world with their ideas. It's a small order, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, we used a sample of your TEDx Columbus talk from 2010, I think it was.
2010.
And you talked about Columbus as a city and how it perceives itself as a city. Mm-hmm. You should be more compared to Florence.
Florence in the Renaissance.
In the Renaissance, right.
I said basically that we benchmark a little too much in this city, and we're always looking to see what Indianapolis is doing or Charlotte or Portland. And I said Columbus should really swing for the fences, and if we're going to benchmark any city, let's try to accomplish what Renaissance Florence accomplished. And I said that we already have a lot of the pieces in place here with our research committee, with our arts community, with our educational community. If we could mash up and mix up that group together, which is what they did in Florence, if we could mix that group up here, we could produce explosive results in this city. the end of my talk, I said, let's try to curate something like that. Let's try to create something. I called it, I gave it the name Universitas. And at the end of my talk, I said, who's with me? And 75 people said, yep, sign me up. Let's do it. So ever since then, we've been meeting at the Columbus Museum of Art once a month to mix up, mash up all the creatives and innovators in the city. And if I can put in a plug, our next gathering is on June 13th at the Columbus Museum of Art, 6 p.m.
And anybody's welcome?
Any and everybody are welcome.
So what are the meetings like?
You know, it depends on the month. We try to do a number of things. This year we've had speakers come in from Tech Columbus, for instance, and they have their tech startup weekends that they do over the course of 2 days. We asked them, could you do something like that in 90 minutes? So we did a session. It was called Change the World in 90 Minutes. Where people came in with their ideas, they developed techniques for turning those ideas into tangible actions, tangible products.
As far as the overarching theme of your talk from 2010, do you feel like Columbus is headed in that direction? Or if you had to go back and say, wait a minute, I got to do this over again?
No, absolutely. I think we are absolutely heading in this direction. What I said in the TED talk is that we already have a lot of creative clusters in the city, and I think that the next step would be to more regularly sort of connect those clusters together. And I'm seeing all sorts of evidence of that happening every single day. I'm very bullish on the future of Columbus, I have to say.
My guest is David Staley. He's director of the Goldberg Center for Excellence in Teaching at OSU, but he's with us today to talk about TEDx Columbus. He's a former TEDx Columbus presenter,
mm-hmm. speaker.
And a speaker, and he's now co-host and curator of TEDx Columbus coming up for the 2012 event on October 5th. If you have a question or comment for David Staley, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org, and you can go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your question or comment there, and we'll try to troll for those.
There's if any of your listeners are sort of unfamiliar with TED, they can, of course, go online and see TED Talks. But I'd also want to draw their attention to an event that TEDx Columbus is sponsoring on June 28th, coming up on June 28th. This will take place at Loth in Grandview, 855 Grandview Avenue. But it's a viewing event, a live viewing event of this year's TED Global. And that's going to start at 9 o'clock on June 28th and run to about 3, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. But it's an attempt to give you some sense of the TED Global experience. And so you hear a number of terrific talks, game-changing talks as part of that afternoon. So that's June 28th.
And we'll post a link to all of that on our website at wosu.org/allsides. TED stands for TED, all caps, Technology, Entertainment.
Or Education.
Education and...
It's both, actually.
Okay, and design,
mm-hmm.
right?
That's right.
When you were first approached to give your TEDx talk in Columbus, did you know what TED was?
I did, yes, and was absolutely thrilled to have been nominated. At that time, it was strictly nominations. It was quite startling to receive that nomination. No, I knew all about TED. Yes,
a lot of people know about TED, but they don't know about TED because they listen to the TED talks, mm-hmm. but they don't understand where the talks came from. I know that's how I sort of came into it. Was when I'd be preparing for shows or something, I'd come across a link to a speech that somebody I wanted to know more about was giving, or a topic, and I would listen to it and didn't really understand what TED was.
I have an interesting anecdote. I have to tell you, I give a lot of speeches all the time. I a good part of my living is public speaking. I actually had stage fright before I went on stage. First
in
time
this particular
since high
time?
School.
Okay.
Yes. For my TED talk, I actually had stage fright.
Well, because with TED talk, not only it's curated, there's a big process that goes on, but then people, they help you prepare for it, mm-hmm. too.
That's right.
Why would you have stage fright in this case, do you think?
Because of all the preparation. because you only
out.
Have 18 minutes, because you're supposed to give the talk of your life. And I think, in the end, I think 400 people, and it wasn't the size of the crowd, it was the composition. It's the sort of people who attend TED. And I told myself, any number in that audience, practically everybody in that audience, could and probably should have been on stage, and I was the one selected. And so I think that was the source of the stage fright. We had 400 that year.
That was the second year.
That was right. That was the second year, and that was held at CCAD. Last year, we were at COSI and had 600. This year, we're expecting probably 700 to 800 people in attendance.
And how much does it cost?
It's $120 this year, $20 of which will be used to underwrite participation by one of the youths in the TEDx Youth event, which is, as you said, October 3rd.
What's the difference between the TEDx Columbus and TEDx Youth Columbus? Because I brought my teenager to TEDx Columbus, and he will never settle for anything less, he says now.
Something on that order in terms of game-changing talks. But TEDx Youth is inspired by youth, run by youth. We now have a set of interns who are going to be running the event this year. Presenters are between the ages of 14 and 25. We also have change agents that will be part of this, also the same age. So we're looking at
change agents,
people who are going to make a difference. Presenters, performers who are going to attend our Big Ideas Incubator session. So in the morning, there are talks, TEDx or TED-like talks, except with young people. In the afternoon, then, we have an idea incubator session, and I was privileged to have tried to herd the cats in that event last year. Just a fabulous event. We had about 100 young people, each with ideas, each brimming with the desire to turn these ideas into actions. And one of the things we want to be able to do is to track those folks from last year. So it's just a fantastic event. All the energy of TED sort of souped up with the vitality of young people.
Do you help prepare the speakers for TEDx Columbus now? Or
that's not officially part of my duty. Mm-hmm. I'm not certain that I have the same sort of skill and qualifications
as Ruth.
But I think having been a TED speaker once, I think I have a certain amount of, I'd like to think I have a certain amount of insight in the process. In addition to 18 minutes, you're restricted to 18 minutes, there's a certain style, a certain TED style that we're looking for, I think, in our presenters.
You have launched. Well, you keep holding this piece of paper.
I just want to draw people's attention to our readers' roundtable that we started as well. This is something that TEDx are doing in a collaboration or in partnership with Our Books, which is a book club that's being run by Catalina Gorla here in Columbus. Where they're bringing back previous TED speakers to talk about, to lead a book discussion on a book that is in some way related to the talk that they gave. So I was pleased to have done this in April, and I did a book called Art Science, which is a book on how to curate creativity. That next event, by the way, is Friday, June 8th. And Jason Barger, who spoke in 2010, will be discussing the film.
Step away from the...
From the baggage,
from the baggage
claim. Yes,
right.
That's Jason's going to be discussing the film Finding Joe. That's at the main library at 11:30. In July, we have Alex Bandar, who was a speaker last year at TEDx, who will be discussing the book Good to Great, Jim Collins' book Good to Great. That's July 11th. That's 6:30 in the evening at the main library.
Does the format include a quick look back at their speak? Their talk?
Only very briefly. It's part of the introduction. Mm-hmm. They encourage everyone who attends the book group to look at the TEDx talk. That's all available on the website. Mm-hmm. And we try to limit these to about 20 people. So you have to sign up. There's a very, very small fee. It pays for the lunch or dinner, mostly. But just a terrific way to continue the TED experience, which is really what we're trying to achieve now. We want TED to be more than just an event that occurs once in October, a terrific event that occurs once in October. We want TED and the TED way of thinking, I guess, to be a part of the life of the city all throughout the year.
To go to the TED, the original TED in California, I think it is, it's very expensive. It's invitation only.
Yes.
Pretty exclusive, even though I think thousands go to it now, but it's still invitation only. Mm-hmm. But they do broadcast every single TED Talk free.
That's right. If you go to the TED site, everyone is you can see every video, and they are inspirational. They truly are inspirational videos.
What do you think about the TED Radio Hour idea on NPR?
Terrific, a terrific way to sort of go beyond the 18 minutes, right? So you're going to get access to these wonderful speakers, but to hear them talk in more detail, more depth. about the ideas that they present at the TED conference. Just a terrific idea.
Okay, and just to remind folks, the TED Radio Hour premieres on WOSU Radio, 89.7 NPR News, this Saturday, if you want to check that out. You have a new feature on your website. It's called Follow This. Can you tell me about that?
Again, a way to continue the conversation beyond the original TED event. So what Follow This is an effort to follow up what happens after TEDx Columbus. What about this idea? Did this idea work? Did that project gain any momentum? What's that speaker up to now? Follow This is a way to continue that conversation.
And what does it really look like? What's it going to look like?
It's available right now. It's up on the website. Uh-huh. If you go to TEDxColumbus.com and click Follow This, you'll be able to get access to this. So, for instance, one of the first people to be profiled is Catalina Gorla, whom I just mentioned, is leading our Readers Roundtable. Alex Bandar is up there and is, again, continuing the ideas that he talked about in his TED Talk. Barbara Font is there, our fabulous poet. Dr. Jennifer Schein-Dyer is up there right now. And so this will be, again, an ongoing regular curated feature of the TEDx Columbus website.
One thing is, everybody, you, Ruth, Milligan, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's still volunteer?
Oh, yes, we do. This is a labor of love for all of us.
Is there any organization that's paid?
Any TEDx organization? Yeah. Boy, I there's so many of them I couldn't tell you, but my sense is that probably no. Most of these are, that would be my sense, that they are volunteer run.
Well, David Staley, thanks for joining us today to tell us about it.
Very happy to be here. Thanks, Anne.
David Staley, you might know him as director of the Goldberg Center for Excellence in Teaching at OSU. He's also a co-host for the upcoming TEDx Columbus Conference on October 5th, and he's helping curate the conference as well, which means he's helping select the speakers that will be coming up on October 5th. If you want to hear about more about TEDx Columbus, you can go to our website at wosu.org/allsides, and you can learn about the October 5th event as well as the October 3rd TEDx Youth at Columbus event. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.